In the late 90s, I had the great pleasure of spending 3 weeks in Turkey with my parents. I think that was the last time the three of us were together. I have a sister, but as you know, it's very special when you have that time just with your parents. And we did the things that most tourists to Turkey would do. We went to Cappadocia and to Ephesus and Troy. But we also did some really interesting things that I don't think are commonly done. We spent almost a week traversing the width of Turkey. And we actually went over to the border with Iran and saw where a crater had fallen. We went over to an area called Van, and there is a lake. And in the middle of that lake is an incredibly beautiful Armenian church. Of course, our guide didn't tell us that it was Armenian, but I had done some research. An incredible Armenian church. All the time we were going across the width of Turkey, there was, I found out later, a policeman who was just in regular everyday clothes following our bus, because the post office in Van had been blown up the week before we went to Van by a Kurdish separatist group. But it was interesting, on this trip, we also were able to stop at some Kurdish villages. At the end of the trip, my parents and I went to Istanbul's Central Bazaar, and as we were heading back to our hotel room, we came across a rug store with the most beautiful carpets you've ever seen. That whole trip, I was looking for a carpet. I was in need of a carpet and would have loved to have one from the trip, but I didn't see anything that I really liked. But in this store, I saw this incredibly beautiful Persian carpet with rich maroon colors and royal blue colors, and the owner quickly picked up that I liked it. Very astutely, and after not much time, he invited me into a side room, and his assistant brought out a large tray of tea. And so we sat there for 3 hours, engaged in conversation, although sometimes just sitting there in silence, just looking at one another, sipping tea, developing a relationship, and trying to see if we could come to some sort of mutual understanding. Now, we were engaged in an elaborate set of rituals. I'm guessing many of you have been engaged in these same rituals, in which both parties had to hang in there until it was felt that both sides had won. Now, about an hour and a half into this negotiation, the owner came down a second time on the price, and my parents, who were sitting behind me, said, "That's great, that's a good price. Let's take it, let's go." And I turned around and I went, "Shh, you are ruining everything that I have been working for. Shh, shh, shh." They wanted to go, and I wanted to keep going, and we kept going. I think my parents were getting a little annoyed. Another hour and a half until a time when, and I actually enjoyed this. I kind of, you know, you learn about some things about yourself in the middle of something like this. I enjoyed this kind of contest, who could outlast the other. And at about the 3 hour point, we came to a price where both of us felt good about. Today's lesson from Genesis brought back memories about bargaining for that rug in Turkey. Abraham here is engaged in some elaborate conversational rituals common in the ancient world, a fairly long negotiation with God. I think it's pretty amazing how much space this story takes up in Genesis, which tells me that the author was trying to say, this is important. Throughout the session, Abraham is polite but firm. He has a strong idea of what God and God's vision for life is like. and he finds himself questioning and pushing God, albeit in the most polite and self-deferential way possible. In the verse before today's reading, which I wish was not left out, it's revealed that God has chosen Abraham, literally known him. The Hebrew chosen can mean known Abraham, so that Abraham and his descendants will preserve God's vision of life by doing righteousness and justice. What do righteousness and justice mean? We throw those words around a lot in church, assuming everybody knows what they mean. In Amazing Grace, A Vocabulary of Faith, Kathleen Norris admits that for years, the word righteousness bugged her, that she had a hard time with it when she heard it in church, because she always associated that word with self-righteousness. She couldn't get around it. As she studied the Bible, she learned that righteousness in the biblical sense does not mean self-righteousness, but righteousness in the sight of God. Well, what does that mean? In the Bible, in the prophets, in the Psalms, in the Gospels, righteousness means a willingness to care for the most vulnerable people in your culture. In ancient Israel, the most vulnerable people were orphans, widows, resident aliens, and the poor. Norris adds, much of the fabled wrath of God in the Hebrew scriptures is directed against those who preserve their own wealth and power at the expense of the lowly. Someone who won't pay a fair wage, for example, or who mistreats an immigrant laborer. In Whistling in the Dark, A Doubter's Dictionary, Frederick Buechner defines justice as what is invoked when you break a good law, not only for goodness' sake, but for the sake of your own soul. Justice may consist of paying a price for what you've done, or simply the painful knowledge that you deserve to pay a price, which is payment enough. Without one form of justice or the other, the result is ultimately disorder and grief for you and everyone else. Thus, justice is itself not unmerciful. In today's passage, God tells Abraham that he has heard an outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah, and that he's going to go see if residents of both towns have done what he has heard. He's going to go check out and do some research on this outcry that he's heard about. Now, while there has been much discussion these last couple of years about Sodom's actual sins, if you look at the biblical record, especially Genesis 19 and Ezekiel 16, Sodom's sins are listed as the following: a failure to offer hospitality, especially the protection and well-being of visitors, arrogance, and having an abundance of food and ease while not doing a thing to help the poor and the needy. Those are Sodom's sins in the biblical record. The sins of Sodom, the way the people of Sodom are separated from God and those around them, is manifest in ignoring those with the greatest needs right in their midst. And so all these actions that the people of Sodom have engaged in or not engaged in have resulted in this outcry that God has heard. In his bargaining session with God, I think Abraham provides a great model for how to approach God in prayer and conversation. Abraham comes to God in the tension between the certainty about who God is from God's revelation to Abraham, Abraham's experience of God, and God's mystery, the things that Abraham will never know about God in this life. So Abraham again approaches God in this conversation in the tension between his certainty about who God is and wanting God to live into who he believes God is, and the mystery of those things that Abraham will never know, at least in this life. Throughout, Abraham argues on behalf of the righteous in Sodom. Will God destroy the righteous along with the wicked? And how many righteous people do there need to be in Sodom to preserve those who have remained faithful? Abraham understands the God who has chosen him as a God who would not want to destroy those who had lived in right relationship with God and others. And interestingly, in these possible scenarios, those who have been faithful end up preserving the life of those who have not. The scene, while serious, is also humorous, which Eric played up a moment ago. In the early part of the passage, if you look at it, the Hebrew can be translated indeed or really, as in would God really kill the righteous along with the wicked? And I personally love Abraham's comment, "Far be that from you, shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just?" Or what about, "Let me take it upon myself to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes." In this scene, God repeatedly uses the phrase, "for the sake of." God is a God who acts for the sake of, on behalf of others. Now, we see some of these same themes in today's gospel from Luke in response to a request from one of his disciples, "Lord, teach us to pray." Jesus shares a very succinct version of what we have come to know as the Lord's Prayer. The main petitions are, "May God's name be holy. May God's kingdom come. May God give us daily bread. Forgive us as we forgive others. And save us for being tested for our faith." In the Lord's Prayer, God is addressed as "our Father" rather than "my Father." The prayer emphasizes kinship rather than tribalism. The fact that God is a God who works not just for our sake, but also on behalf of others. In the parable Jesus shares after sharing this prayer, the parable highlights a neighbor's shameless persistence in asking for some food for a visitor. The neighbor is asking for help in order to provide hospitality to the unexpected visitor. And this is kind of a ridiculous story. We don't ever really see this happening in the ancient world, but Jesus is just trying to show how ridiculous this case scenario would be. We are similarly to pray persistently, like the persistent neighbor banging on his neighbor's door until he gets the bread. We're to pray persistently like this neighbor and like Abraham for the resources, physical, spiritual, and material, to care for those who depend on our hospitality. If you look at it closely, the Lord's Prayer is pretty shameless. It's pretty direct. Maybe you'd say bold. "Give us, forgive us, save us." There is no question what the prayer desires. Taken as a whole, the Lord's Prayer seems to imply that when God's name is widely revered as holy, when God's kingdom is even more fully revealed, there will be bread for everyone, sins will be forgiven, reconciliation between those who are estranged will take place, and the faithful will be saved from times of trial. In both the story of Abraham negotiating subtly with God in the 18th chapter of Genesis, and in Jesus' gift of the Lord's Prayer, and the story of the persistent neighbor, we see people acting on behalf of others. People of God acting on behalf of others. God works through our awareness of and concern for those who are hungry and in need of healing. God desires our prayers, as well as our actions, to participate in God's work to bring a meal, shelter, and hope to those who are hungry, homeless, and hurting. Protection to the vulnerable and faithful. And mercy and a new beginning to those who have committed grave ills against God and others. All of this is underscored by the fact that God is our Father, our God, not just my Father, my God. Amen.